If you go to page two, mine doesn't have numbers for some reason. So, but go to the second page. And if you are at home, then you go to the second page as you scroll down through the article at home. He says, we now need a complex way of thinking about the diverse and intersecting set of issues raised by this war and a heuristic, which means kind of learning from experience, that enables us to make sense of what it means to be a Jew right now. So it's not learning that's analytical and up here. It's learning that is about the experiences we're having. And as we muddle our way through it, that's the method that's going to be best, right now, he feels, to help us. We need a Torah, and Torah, of course, means teaching in our tradition. So we tend to use it as a proper noun, but it is a big concept, meaning teaching. So we need a Torah, a teaching for this war. I offer the following as a moral map, a framework for ethical thinking that consists of a set of concrete moral commitments that can define the uncertain terrain of issues raised by the war. I am thinking more prescriptively than descriptively. And so for this exercise, I'm interested in commitments to concrete Jewish ideas and values. I hope that we as Jews can confront what is before us more comprehensively and that the language of our tradition can help us hold ourselves accountable. So he's not saying, here's the moral and ethical values that we can name so we get to do what we want, whatever that is, fill in the blank, but rather, here's a way to think about our obligations and something that will help hold us accountable for whatever we decide we want or need to do. All right, so the map that he's talking about consists of four overarching commitments. So these are our obligations. These are moral in his world, in his mind, and in his writing. These are moral obligations. The first of those obligations is peoplehood or solidarity, right? Yes. And this ties into what we've been studying, right? So this would be what kind of ethics?
Covenant.
Exactly. This is covenant ethics, right? So he's talking about that being, and that is a Jewish obligation, a set of, it's a moral commitment that we have a commitment to Jewish solidarity and peoplehood. All right. So in that neighborhood, what are we looking at? The response of most American Jews to October 7th under the first stop on the map. The response of most Americans to that attack was an overwhelming outburst of solidarity and the expression of a commitment to Jewish peoplehood. That was immediate. That was right away. That was instinctual. It was like somebody bangs your knee under the kneecap and your cab goes flying out, right? It was instinctive. In retrospect, this was not a given, which I hadn't thought about. Because we all lived it, it was heuristic to me, duh. But it's like, I hadn't thought about that. Like, that was not a given, is what he's suggesting. Many of us have argued for decades with concern and urgency that the sense of Jewish peoplehood and with it the experience of shared fate or a sense of having a shared destiny that characterized American Jewish attitudes after the Holocaust and during the birth of the State of Israel was eroding as a result of geographic difference, ideological difference, and the passage of time, right? From those major formative moments, one a crisis, then an opportunity, the Holocaust, the war for independence, and then the founding of the State of Israel, that those things like brought the Jewish people together, in a way that was like in some ways unprecedented in modern times. But that had begun to seriously fray. And when I go back to pre-October 7th, it's like, oh yeah. That is absolutely true. Right. So he's right. It was not a given that once again, right, crisis brought us to a place of solidarity. All right. So go to your next page, whatever that is. I guess it's three or whatever. That big middle paragraph on the page, we're going to go to the bottom of that paragraph. These demonstrate that our ability to organize the Jewish community in a time of crisis remains intact, despite mounting threats to, quote, the establishment that we have seen and heard over the past few decades. The Jewish community has also shown its strength politically, as public officials have overwhelmingly expressed support for Israel and the Jewish community and providing funding for Israel's war effort and for the Jewish community's fight against anti-Semitism. All right. So not only did this bring us together as a people, but it also demonstrated that we have some strength politically. Think originally, and we're not right now necessarily, but when this first happened, right, that it seems there was overwhelming support, and there was actually funding, right, by the American government for, what Israel felt had to happen and the fight here against anti-Semitism. This surprising demonstration of solidarity among American Jews mirrored the surprising solidarity of Israeli society in response to October 7th. Think about pre-October 7th, what was happening in Israel. All the demonstrations, all the tearing apart of the Israeli community that was happening. He's suggesting like it wasn't necessarily so that they came together either. Immediately before the war, Israelis were as divided politically as they have ever been after 40 consecutive weeks of massive protests against the government's efforts at a radical judicial reform. The October 7th attacks reawakened a shared concern about the urgency of self-defense that runs from left to right in Israel. This did not end the political divides, though in some way it forced them to the side. He says probably only temporarily. Now we know for sure it was only temporarily. When some of the organizations that had been at the head of the protest movements in Israel now lent their frameworks to relief efforts, they were not conceding their claims against a government they oppose. Rather, they were expressing the patriotic claim that citizens must take responsibility for their society's most urgent needs in a new way. It did not mean that the arguments were over. It meant what rose to the top now of what everybody needed to do was like put right their obligation to do what they could for the society that had to go to the top of the list at a moment when they are particularly angry at their government's failure to protect them. Israelis seem to understand intuitively that solidarity is more than an ideal. And I think this holds for everything the rabbis talk about when they talk about ideals. It's more than an ideal. So we have to figure out how to put these things into actual practice. It is an essential commitment to help a society navigate through a difficult time, especially when external threats are more dangerous than internal ones. So solidarity, in Kurtzer's thinking, becomes an ethical expression. I won't say obligation. It didn't have to be that one, but it's an ethical commitment that he and all of us have seen in response to October 7th in Israel. Next page, end of the first paragraph on that page. If the point of solidarity is that it offers the safety of others and the comfort of belonging, we must strive to make the circles of inclusion wider in these moments, not narrower. So that can be self-evident. It can also be challenging, right, to accept, right? Like if solidarity means we're offering safety to ourselves and to others and offering the comfort of belonging, that's what peoplehood is about, then we must strive to make the circles of inclusion wider rather than narrow, which goes against the trends both in America and in Israel pre-October 7th. Skip the next paragraph, go down to the next one. Many Zionist Jews, even on the liberal left, have discovered that their ties with allies in other faiths and ethnic groups were weaker than they had thought. So this goes to solidarity, not to peoplehood, but that's why it's a slash solidarity, because we thought we had solidarity. I will speak for myself, but those of us on the left understood that we had solidarity with other communities that have been oppressed and whatever, and we are politically aligned in so many ways and socially aligned and our values we thought were aligned. And it turns out that we thought they were stronger than they turned out to be. Another casualty of the way that war polarizes us and forces the redrawing of group lines into oppositional camps rather than complex networks. It is a reasonable response to both trends for American Jewish groups and institutions to redraw their own alliances in turn, to renegotiate the rules of belonging in Jewish life, and to rethink what we want and need out of allies, even after decades of hard-won accomplishments. That is a sad statement, but a true one. It is sad. He's not saying this glibly. He's not saying this stridently. He's saying this matter of fact. And I know him well enough to know he says it with great sadness that we're going to have to renegotiate where the lines are. I was with a group of moms right after October 7th. And one of the things, you know, I was called to hold space for, and there was like 40 moms in a room, high powered, connected, whatever moms. And they said, and one of them, two of them, three of them said, I don't care who the Republican candidate is. That's who I'm voting for. Now this is immediately post, right? And so like, I had to like, you know, bite down hard and take a deep breath and say, so why is your knee jerk reaction that the Republican Party will be the one to best protect Israel and the Israel-American relationship? But what Kurtzer is saying is that for those three, they had redrawn the lines. They saw, they assessed, and they redrew their lines. And now it was, we don't care who the Republican candidate is. That's who we're voting for. I'm not saying that's where they still are. I don't know. But he's saying everyone now has to redraw lines.
And that.
So.
Terminology.
Yeah. Huh?
What does redrawing the line mean? I just don't understand.
When we think where our alliances are and where they've been strong and where they've been productive, this suggested to us that those relationships were not as strong as we thought.
The line meaning key.
Yes.
Not a boundary. I thought more like.
Meaning we have to rethink alliances and where the lines in those alliances are that I'm willing to work on behalf of this community. But if they're going to be anti-Zionist / parenthetically anti-Semitic, maybe I don't know what my commitment is now to that community or that agenda. Right. And so I'm just talking about three moms who had been undecided and now like they redrew their understanding where their lines were around alliances and who's in and who's I like, and because that's what it caused all of us to have to do.
But they're creating their own solidarity. I mean, this is all based on the a priori assumption that we start with solidarity.
No, we start with peoplehood and solidarity to our peoplehood. We had an experience of solidarity with other peoples too. Right. Like on a certain part of the spectrum on right or the left, and he's saying we, by watching how they have responded, we have had to rethink those lines. And I think that's very true. And for many of us, I can't speak for the right. I can only speak for the left. But for those of us on the left, it has been incredibly disruptive and disorienting to have to rethink what we considered primary commitments, primary alliances, primary relationships with other communities and other folk that now it's not so clear. And so all of that renegotiation he's suggesting is in an ethical framework of solidarity. With whom are we in solidarity? Do you just say, okay, we're not going to talk about Israel? Right. So we'll talk about this other stuff and we're still in solidarity. Is it possible to just say the Jewish part of me doesn't matter in the conversation about our solidarity? Right. So that's different from peoplehood in terms of Jewish peoplehood. Does that make sense? Okay. Yes.
Are we more surprised or disappointed in this? Because the fog of war and everything that happens immediately, there is certainly a predictable solidarity that people feel at that moment and things sort of, you know, go by the wayside. And then it goes into, I mean, it happened 9/11 too. And then it goes into, and we go back to how we normally were. But what you're saying is that it's revealing something that is even more devastating, which are things that were already there, but maybe...
that we didn't know.
Did we not know them or not choose to look at?
I don't know. How are you going to prove from a state of absence? Like, I don't know how you prove from a state of absence which one of those it is. It doesn't matter. The result is we have to reassess the relationships. Whether we didn't see it or we chose not to see it, it doesn't matter. What matters, I mean, I'm not saying it doesn't matter. No. Scholars and sociologists can study it for decades and we'll hear articles 30 years from now that said, well, we totally should have seen it. We chose not, whatever. And I'm not saying that dismissively. I'm saying he's suggesting it's the incredible ethical challenge of the moment is reassessing those relationships and those ways of feeling or experiencing solidarity.
It seems to me the last 50 years for Jews in the United States have been completely atypical for Jews in our history. And I think that part of the big shock, at least for me, was I thought that was the way things were. And now I realize that was the anomaly. We're bipartisan. Everybody was pro-Israel. There was anti-Semitism, but Jews are pretty well accepted. You get, an attack on Israel and the government and everybody. This is unique in Jewish history. This is not how we have lived for 2,000 or however many thousand years. Now, and I mean, this is my discomfort, we're kind of back to the way it was and the way it's always been.
So the way Kurtzer talks about this and the way Hartman, and it's not just Hartman, but that's my reference. So just forgive me if I keep saying Hartman because that's my only reference for it, really. In the field, they talk about it as American exceptionalism. What you're describing, they talk of the code for it, the buzzword for it is American exceptionalism, that we thought America was different.
Oh.
Because the Jewish experience in America has been exceptional, only matched by the golden age of Spain, mm-hmm. right? Jews living under Islam, mm-hmm. ironically. The good times were the Jews living in Spain under Islam in the medieval period. So the golden age of Spain and America in the contemporary era. And post World War II. Mm-hmm. So the challenge is also to all of our understanding that there is American exceptionalism. Once you started seeing anti-Semitism and the kind of responses you have going on in America, there's now a sense of maybe it wasn't exceptional, right? That maybe what we didn't see or chose not to see, now that it's coming up, we're like, okay, well, maybe America is not exceptional. And this is a conversation happening. No one has an absolute, well, some people have absolutes on the ends, but this is the conversation is there such a thing as American exceptionalism? And a lot of Israelis want to say, no, you've been delusional the whole flipping time. We told you. That's why we made Aliyah. Right? And other folks say, no, of course there's American exceptionalism. This is a blip. This is, okay, it's showing us the fissures. It's showing us the tension points where a bridge might collapse. Right? This is a point. So, okay. But there is still this thing of American exceptionalism in some way that we want to commit to and live into.
We're having two conversations. One is how we view the relationships of the rest of America to Jews, and the other is the relationship solidarity with Israel and their activities going on now.
We are not having two conversations. We are having one conversation about solidarity and peoplehood. There are many legs to that topic. Mm-hmm. Two of them are what you just said, which I can't remember, but you said, So let's talk about two legs of that bubble. The bubble is solidarity, peoplehood. Now, what are some of the legs underneath that?
It's in our relationship with Israel and the activities going on now with the war. How does our solidarity as Jews fit with the activities going on in the war? That's one solidarity. The other solidarity with Jews in America and the relationship with all these other organizations that we find out, you know, ain't so friendly.
Yes. So those are two legs.
I didn't hear that. We find out what
the relationship with other organizations in America that are not as friendly to the Jews as
we find out that are not as friendly.
Yeah. Okay. So those are two legs to the big bubble of solidarity.
I think as I'm absorbing the two thoughts, one is the surprise of Jewish solidarity. Israel, American Jewish, is that people's Jewish identity. This goes back to class last year. Their Jewish identity is so core that they identify with the Jewish state, even if they've never been to Israel, even if they have no interest in Israel. An attack on Israel poked their Jewishness. But I think this peoplehood solidarity piece saying to us as a value, the prime value is taking care of ourselves. And we have, as opposed to, as good liberals, our primary value is to take care of people who are marginalized or to take care of people who are in need. And the Jewishness in us does not need to be protected. We don't need to, see ourselves as the primary responsibility to take care of
ourselves. Okay. So you just said a lot and that was a lot because you're super amazing. But So
it was two different thoughts. One about Americans and one about like this idea of my primary responsibility in this country is to myself and my people.
Okay. So part of what he's saying is we expected that the same way I take care of you as a marginalized oppressed person because of your skin color or the plumbing of the person that you sleep with, like the same way I take care of you, you'll take care of me. That was the agreement. That was the solidarity. And what he's saying is the shock to Jews was that we would have to have our Jewishness be something that was particular again. They were supposed to say the same thing to us. The same way you stood with us and marched at Selma, the same way you've argued for us, or now you're under attack, we're coming to you. We're coming to your aid. We have a solidarity understanding that was unarticulated or not, whatever you call it, unspoken, but it was 100% our commitment and has been. So the shock was that, wait a minute, if it's about my Jewish self, I'm not going to get the support that my female or my queer or my colored or my what feel handicapped, you know, differently abled, whatever it is. I'm not going to get the same. We're there for you because I'm a Jew. Mm-hmm. So that was a shock for American Jews to go, wait a minute. We had an agreement. We've been voting against our own pocketbook to make sure that everyone was taken care of, because that's just a second, John. So but it's a distraction when people keep raising their hand and I'm trying to talk.
Yeah, go ahead.
So that was a shock to a lot of American Jews. And it was, and I'm going to use this word on purpose, a betrayal of the understanding of the solidarity that we felt we had been demonstrating, whether we did or not. But we felt we'd been demonstrating and it wasn't returned. So that is hugely disorienting. And now it's like, well, wait a minute. So what does that mean vis-a-vis my sense of soul? When women flying a rainbow flag with a Jewish star on it are kicked out of the march because you're a Jew and this is a queer march. And if you're a Jewish queer, you're out. For me, what am I supposed to do with that? Am I more lesbian or more Jewish? Am I more female or more brunette? Like, you're asking me to choose between the solidarity, the belongings that define my existence, that define my identity, that define my life. And it's existentially shocking. So that goes to the one point, and then the other point that you said.
The other point is just the recognition that my Jewish identity takes primary place over all these other identities.
When we are attacked and people don't come to the aid of us
What he's saying is, and that is a positive value. That is what we should be doing.
Is what?
Taking care of ourselves and taking care of
I think Kurtzer is saying there's one part of solidarity that's about peoplehood, and that's Jewish peoplehood. He is so sad about this. Okay. He is so sad. I cried with him in a shiur, in a lecture. I cried with him about the fact that it's crumbled on the left. And this was before October 7th. We were talking about the illiberalism on the far left and how betrayed those of us who are fighters and truly true believers and holy rollers for liberalism have seen where we've been betrayed on the left by the illiberalism that we're seeing, fascism, that we're seeing on the left. So now it's only in more stark, painful contrast. Does that make sense?
Interesting.
Jeff?
I didn't mean to interrupt.
It's okay. It's okay. It's okay.
Maybe everyone should know.
Just good. Go on. Just ask your question.
I have a socially handicapped sticker on my car. I don't take myself.
What would you like to ask, Jeff?
I'm reading this very carefully, and all of this is it's very interesting, and I think I may have told you once I was in one of the Catholic – I was the only Jew in a Catholic school in 1963, and two former Nazi – sons of Nazi supervisors came up to me and said, you know what we do with Jews in Argentina? They moved to Argentina. We put them in the oven. So I understand this feeling. Okay, but let me go into here. Okay. And I'm reading directly, and I think it really makes sense. This really hit me. When some of the organizations that have been at the head of the protest movement in Israel now lent their frameworks to relief efforts, they were not conceding their claims against the government. Rather, this is the point, they were expressing the patriotic claim that citizens must take responsibility for their society's most urgent needs in a new way. So he's talking about looking at the things we've always done, they've always done, in a new way. Open your mind. But here we go.
Where are you?
I'm on, what page is this?
Okay, so we're going now to the bottom paragraph
on
the page that we were on. So you're ahead of where we are.
No,
so if you will please let me read that paragraph, and then we can talk about it.
Behind.
Are you behind?
Yeah.
Where? Okay. Okay. So tell me where you are.
It's page 3, I think. Bottom of page 3.
Okay.
Let me just say what I'm saying.
Okay.
Okay. Israel seemed to understand too that solidarity is more than an ideal. To me, that is the most powerful statement. Solidarity is more than an ideal. And to me, that's a statement of primal needs, what we really need. Every people, no matter who they are, who get attacked, join together primally. And then, we're on this next page. Many Zionist Jews, even on the liberal left, discovered that their ties with allies.
Yeah, so that's what we just read.
Yeah. Were weaker than they had thought.
Yeah.
I don't
so we just talked about that.
Yeah, that's where. Is it weaker or is the fact that, look, when a war starts, this is classic stuff to me. And I've seen it. That those who get attacked are going to quickly join together, and those outside that are going to go, oh, wait a minute, do we want to be around these people or what?
Okay, great. That's so, all I'm saying. Yep, so we just talked about that.
It's a primal thing and a political thing.
It's just that we do all four because they comment on each other, and if we just do one.
I understand. So we're either going to get through it all or we're not. So
there's a lot of things to get through it all.
Okay, so we can push forward.
But a quick footnote. The term American exceptionalism is also used by the right wing, like Mike Pence and Donald Trump, to mean that America is exceptional in the world, the best country that there is, everything we do is right, et cetera, et cetera.
So I want to be clear. Sense. I meant in the Jewish community, when we talk American exceptionalism, we're saying the experience for the Jews has been different in America than anywhere else. Yeah. And we trust that to protect us in a way that has never been possible outside of the land of Israel.
I just want to point out that
I appreciate
the people that.
All right, so dropping down to the last paragraph on the page we were on, whatever page that is, solidarity then is our first moral commitment. We need to solidify Jewish community in this moment, no doubt with a new set of rules and a bit of reckoning, without shrinking its bounds. He's not arguing, hunker down and pull in. He's arguing the tent needs to be wider than ever. And I believe that is counterintuitive. We kind of want to circle the wagons.
Yeah.
And who's safest for us in our community? And he's suggesting no. The answer is counterintuitive. It's widen the circle because that's how we will actually be safest. It makes me nervous. Makes me very nervous. And I don't think he's wrong. Our strengths will be in how wide we can keep the tent and in how wide we can keep that circle. Okay. So he says, we will need to do this even as a brutal war will become more brutal, which we've seen. And even as we find ways to tolerate and promote diverse opinions about war tactics, Harvey, to your point, and Israeli democracy in ways that echo the conversations that Israelis themselves will be having. So the same conversations we're having here are happening in Israel, right? They are already, and we don't hear this, by the way, because I watch CNN and MSNBC. I don't see any coverage of the conversation in Israel about what's happening with the war. We hear a lot of coverage about Israel and the war. We don't hear, and we hear lots of professionals talking about Israel and what's happening with the war. We don't hear a lot about what's happening within Israel. If you want to make Israel the topic du jour every day because you got nothing else to talk about, why don't you talk to Israelis about what is actually happening within Israel? Because the criticism is already huge for Netanyahu and his government, and that there's no plan, and that everyone feels like he's dragging on the war so that he doesn't go to prison. And like, it's already a starting to be a heated debate in Israel. No one talks about it. All right. So the second one is the second ethical category that he's going to talk about as a commitment and as a responsibility is sovereignty. Did I spell that right? I can't spell
close enough.
Sovereignty.
Yeah.
Sovereignty, right?
For me.
Oh, no, I need another E.
Sovereignty.
You got it.
All right. So sovereignty. It would make no sense. So sovereignty. Go to the second sentence in that first paragraph. Diaspora existence has been rooted in ambiguous otherness. At times, Jews could be proximate to the halls of power and could benefit from its privileges, and at other times, not. Sovereignty reversed the dynamic. To be sovereign is to be in charge. And thus, and here we go, I was not expecting this when I read this, and thus to be responsible for whatever transpires within one's borders. The reality of the Jewish state demands a shift in mindset. This is bold, bold thinking, people. This is bold. Like, this is out there. I love that about what he says, whether we agree or not. Okay, next paragraph, in the middle. The harder challenge for Zionism and a precondition for its fulfillment is accepting that every single aspect of what takes place in Israel's sovereign borders takes place under the auspices of the state. Jews must accept that as a normative reality, and Israel must govern accordingly. He's suggesting that this is completely counterintuitive, even though we have a state. That if you're a sovereign state, then everything that happens within your borders is your responsibility. You can't say, but. No, if you are a sovereign state, then you have to start acting, thinking, and behaving like a sovereign state. It's all your responsibility. What happens within your borders and at your borders, he's going to go on to say. All right.
Especially,
it has been astonishing and horrifying as Israel fights an essential war on its southern border and fortifies its northern border to see the collapse of Israeli police and military responsibility in the West Bank and the rise of settler vigilantism against Palestinians, as well as the relentless fear-mongering and seeding of suspicion, not to mention violence, either with state sanction or in the state's absence, against Palestinian citizens of Israel. There can be no rationalization of the state's failure to protect its citizens or the people it is responsible for under occupation. I personally support pursuing an end to occupation in the West Bank. That he's, Yehuda Kurzer is modern Orthodox. Like, he's not a left winger. A commitment to peace and justice for both Israelis and Palestinians, who I see as interdependent, is essential to my Zionism, he's saying. But even for those who are willing to abide the status quo in the West Bank, the failure to protect its inhabitants must be understood as a source of shame. What is the point of leading a state if you are willing to abdicate the core responsibility of protecting the people under your watch? The end of that next paragraph. More than absolution, and he's talking about a ritual that the Kahan Commission is referencing in the Talmud and in the Bible. The ritual attests to the truth of the matter. We are responsible. They, meaning the people of the town, are responsible, meaning for finding a dead body between two towns. Whoever the body's closest to is legally responsible. Because whoever's in charge of the public square has to be responsible for whatever transpires in its midst. Sovereignty entails the acceptance on a national level that you are not allowed to remain indifferent. It's not happening to us. Oh, well, we can't control them. We can't control the rioting. We can't control, right? It's not happening to us. Right? You're not allowed to remain indifferent. Hamas's act of war violated Israeli sovereignty, and Israel's response is consistent with the rights granted internationally to sovereign countries. No country in the world could abide Hamas's invasion and maintain credibility as a protector of its citizens. So, of course, Israel has to protect its citizens. And if you attack our citizens, we have to ensure first and foremost the safety of our citizens. So a response is necessary. By the same token, no country can tolerate vigilantism and structural racism within its borders and maintain credibility that it understands the responsibilities of sovereignty. Israel's campaign against Hamas in Gaza is intertwined with its responsibilities for Palestinians within its borders. Zionists must not look away from the ways in which Israel's extreme right is leveraging the Hamas invasion to change the status quo for Palestinians in Israel and the West Bank. Israel's just cause for war around the world is compromised. The right to execute a just war is compromised when extremists turn an Israel-Hamas war into a war between Israelis and Palestinians, mm-hmm. or even worse, between Jews and Muslims. An overreach by Israel's extremists will, in the long run, compromise the moral credibility of Israel's claims to sovereignty as recognized in the international community. And we must not look away because an Israeli failure to govern morally becomes a referendum on our Zionist aspirations to be in charge of our own destiny. This is a bold statement that is unequivocal. And for me, what is so refreshing about this kind of thinking about these things is that one doesn't cancel the other, right?
Yep.
Israel's right to execute a just war to protect its citizens does not have anything to do with Israel making that war about Israelis and Palestinians or about Jews and Muslims. Like that's a false equivalency. Not only is it a false equivalency, but it will undermine our Zionism because that's not the Zionism we believe in, and that is not fulfilling the ethical and moral responsibility in the category of sovereignty. The Palestinians who fall under your care as a sovereign state, Israel, are your responsibility. And so this, for Kurzer, is like the next big category of how do we deal with our ethical and moral responsibilities and the complications of that when you're talking about a place like Israel.
I couldn't help think of the Japanese internment camps in this country
mm-hmm.
in the Second World
mm-hmm.
War. And our, I would say, lack of responsibility,
right,
in particular to our Japanese American citizens
right.
who were here. That it, now, we didn't, I don't think we had the kind of the wild vigilantism that one is seeing in the West Bank right now. But, that's a stain on America.
Yeah. Big time. Yeah. And I don't mean to make it huger than it is, but just look at the attacks on Asians and COVID, right? The vigilantism is real. Like the minute you decide they're not worthy of the protection of the sovereign state because they are somehow compromised. Somebody recently, like, so helpfully, you know,
recently,
right? All right. The next category he's going to bring to us in terms of rights and responsibilities is democracy. All right. And we can all, I think, agree, right? Between America and Israel, this is a shared category of moral and ethical obligation and privilege and something we should be excited about. Like, yeah. Okay. So go to the next page after that. First full paragraph. A serious commitment to democracy does not take a break during a war. And the decision to give Israel's military the benefit of the doubt is not code for supporting the government without judgment or criticism. I always think when you wrote this, I always think about the Iraq war, right? It's like, just because you think there's justification for that does not mean our government, just because we're at war does not mean our government is free because we're at war to be uncriticized, to be free of criticism. Right. So there may be some sort of solidarity that we have as a people behind our country that's at war, but it is not code for supporting the government without judgment or criticism. Striving towards better leadership in Israel, which respects the structure and values of liberal democracy, is an essential means of fighting the war. A free press, a robust public square, government accountability, and a balanced chain of command are tools in service of a just war fought justly. Drop down to the second to the last paragraph. Israel's liberal democratic character must remain front and center, even or especially in wartime. As we think about, quote, the next day in Gaza, we must also ask what it will take for Israel to guarantee its security while also ensuring democratic governance. It is not a coincidence that Israeli security establishment tends to believe that until and unless Palestinian national claims are reconciled with Israeli claims to sovereignty, Israel's safety will never be ensured. There is no such thing as democracy for some within a shared polity. As Israel acts on its commitment to democracy, American Jews must stay committed to the tools and values of liberal democracy to fight the aftershock battles that the war in Gaza has catalyzed here. Erosion of the line between anti-Zionism and anti-Semitism, clashes between concerns for the safety of American Jews and protection of First Amendment rights to speech and assembly, the deterioration of pluralism in liberal institutions, and the collapse of an independent press in the face of global campaigns of disinformation aided by algorithms that incentivize and reward falsehood. So these are the very, very real aftershocks of not only the war, but they're exacerbated by the war, right? These were already well underway, but now the war has exposed, right, like how huge that is, anti-Zionism and anti-Semitism. We didn't see it or we didn't want to see it. Whichever it is, it's now an aftershock that we are going to have to deal with, right? Safety of American Jews at free speech. That's a tough one, right? All these, you know, presidents getting grilled, right, about what is free speech? And what do we think about that? What is free speech? As somebody who's been, again, on the left, somebody who's been an ardent supporter of free speech, where's the line? Is it okay that people feel completely unsafe, like with some of the things that are being said that can actually encourage violence? I mean, I'm just, this is a real aftershock here in America. And the deterioration of pluralism is probably in my lifetime one of the saddest tragedies of life in our time right now, is the real true deterioration of pluralism in liberal institutions. And the collapse of an independent press, right? that we don't have an independent press that kind of everybody kind of turns to see reflected back what's happening. That I don't know if you've heard me use it before, but this idea that used to be we all turned on Walter Cronkite, we turned Peter Jennings was my favorite.
Oh, okay.
Just saying. ABC. So you turn on your news at night and everybody was looking into a mirror that reflected back what was happening in America, right? Whether you liked it or didn't like it, whatever your opinions were after you turned it off and your arguments were, fine. But everyone was looking into the mirror that reflected back American and world reality as we understood it from the facts. And now someone, I wish I could remember because we always teach B'Shem Amro, we teach in the name of our teacher. Someone said, take a brick and throw it at the mirror. Now, what's on the floor? That's what we see. We pick up a shard. And that is all we see. And everybody else has a different chart, right? So everybody else is looking at a different sort of angle, piece, whatever, based on what's coming into their inboxes, what's coming into their feed, what's coming into their YouTube, what's coming to their Facebook, what's coming in. So now we don't have some kind of independent reflection to us that we can all talk about and argue about and discuss. And that is a serious aftershock of modernity. And now with the war and Israel and all of that, even worse. We have alternate facts and disinformation, the selection, as we know from the testimony in court, right? We know now that the algorithms support anything that will get you to engage with the technology, because right. That buys ad dollars, your eyes on the screen, and they can tell that by the fact that you like or hate it. And if you respond, you blah, 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 that's the best because you've taken the time to write words. So it will feed you, the algorithm will feed you whatever's most likely to have you respond again. So the level gets higher and higher and higher of the outrage that they will feed you to make sure you're engaging, because that's ad dollars for the companies. So we know there's disinformation and the algorithms are feeding, right, that shard getting edgier and edgier and edgier and sharper all the time. All right, next page, top of the page. Wars incentivize anti-democratic behavior. We're seeing that in Israel for sure. Netanyahu would have fallen by now were it not for the war. Because there are enough people saying call for a new government. And so, but enough ministers have to pull out for the government to fall. And right now, do you think anybody's going to say, hi, I'm pulling out of a unity government at a time of war? And then they're going to drive home, trusting that their brakes aren't like, haven't been, right? I mean, the brake cable hasn't been cut. Wars incentivize anti-democratic behavior because we're inclined to grab onto measures that temporarily limit our liberty in pursuit of safety. Israel will be tested on this front, and increasingly, North American Jews are similarly tested as we confront the problem of anti-Semitism. The bottom of that paragraph, disproportionate fear brought on by a sense of vulnerability and an instinct towards solidarity could make the situation here much worse, meaning solidarity without thought. Just an instinct out of fear to solidarity rather than, okay, let me assess where does my solidarity belong? Where does my loyalty belong? Where, right? And to act out of fear is natural. He's not saying it's not natural. He's saying, though, that like we know, the amygdala starts screaming. And what happens? Faye Kagan, the Kagans over there, the doctors Kagan, what happens when the amygdala starts screaming? Can off? Huh? Hmm? The frontal lobes shut down and we start to use only primal thinking, right? Instinct. And that is a terrible recipe at a dangerous time. I mean, it served us once upon a time, but it is a dangerous, dangerous thing. And that's what I see happening. It's been happening for a long time around the conversation about Israel. But now it's at a pitch that, you know, is, and in action, like people, like I said, three people said, I'll vote for the Republican candidate, whoever it is. Meaning I'm not even going to look at their policies. I'm not even going to look at their approach. I'm not even going to look, just right, boom, amygdala. And I do it too. I'm not suggesting it's just them on the other side. Like I do it too. And so he's suggesting we're going to have to be very, very careful and we're going to have to be vigilant, right? About not letting that take over everything. Number four, big one, power. So go to the bottom paragraph. This idea, don't worry about what it is. You'll read it. Is the basic precondition of a Torah of the legitimacy and dignity of Jewish power. But in recent years, that argument has eroded. It is more common to hear people argue against the very legitimacy of the idea of survival for its own sake. Today, questions about the ethical use of power and survival are not theoretical. Israel's war against Hamas is a just war. This is the normative position among Israeli Jews, and the principled position for American Jews is to support them in that fight. The legitimacy of the fight brings with it a set of expectations related to the ethics of war. For diaspora Jews to be good allies, we must concentrate our attention and, if necessary, our criticism on the question of whether Israel is fighting this war justly, this just war justly. This may also require us to be character witnesses for the state of Israel rather than standing dispassionately to the side, knowing that the ethics of war tradition is built into the chain of command of the IDF and trusting that it constantly factors into Israeli military decision making. But we can only do that if we come to terms with the reality of Jewish power, which is a massive generational and educational challenge, right? We have all grown up with people who said they can kill us, they can kill us, they can destroy us, they can destroy. This is a new generational and educational challenge, which is to accept the reality of Jewish power. We are uncomfortable with that. We are, as a people, deeply uncomfortable, unfamiliar with, and I'm going to read into him because we are uncomfortable with and therefore can misthink because we don't take seriously Jewish power, Israeli power, Jewish power here and Israeli power. And if we don't take that seriously and get comfortable with how powerful the Israeli military is, we cannot be the best ethical character witnesses on the one hand and critics on the other that we need to be.
But doesn't the power stoke anti-Semitism? Weren't we, didn't we do so much better when we were under
the of course, but that's not the point. The point isn't about them. If you just want to make that as a point, yes, of course you're right. He's saying we are uncomfortable with Jewish power. We still see ourselves as the victim. We still see ourselves as the lambs going to slaughter. We still see ourselves as 2,000 years of worth of, like, we are the ones uncomfortable. Forget them. Yes, of course it works against us now with folks who are ready to jump on.
Are we saying that
whatever?
Believing in our own power is going to be better?
Yes, because if we don't, then we make decisions based on, I'm afraid I'm going to be flattened, and so watch me come out swinging. If we understand that we truly have power in the region, then that power can be used responsibly, and there can be critics from within, both Israeli Jewish society and those who contribute outside of Jewish society, and American Jews. We can assess with the frontal lobes what should be done. And is Israel fighting this just war justly? And we can't do that if we're always saying, well, we don't have power. We're the victims. Everyone's going to beat up on us. And then we are failing our responsibility and our ethical responsibility vis-a-vis having power.
So unpopular opinion, when October 7th heard, felt extremely empowered. As a Jewish person,
empowered.
I was like, wow, like this is how big and reactive the whole world is to our story, our identity, our military, our state, you know, our assemblies. I was blown away, and I was like, wow, this is a really big flipping deal because of all the impact it had on the rest of the world, frankly. So I think, you know, I'm not really a military person. Like, I'm not really just, that's not my personal interest, you know, of a lot. But I think that looking at all the different pillars, like, lined up, they all feed into power in not only a military, but in the strength of power.
Do you feel that way still?
Heck yeah. Mm-hmm. I feel super amped. Like, I really am stoked about being a Jewish person. And I'm like, enough of all the whining and kvetching that everybody did my entire existence. Like, now it's time for people to kind of recommit all of these very true birthright and inclusion of community and be like, yeah, and we're here and we're not going nowhere, peeps. Homies, like, be friends with us or get over yourself type of thing.
All right, witness people. So,
yeah.
Witness Jewish young people.
Yeah.
Who are not as impacted by the generational understandings and traumas and tropes. And that, not that they're untrue. I'm just saying they are so, we are so laden with them that Kurtzer is suggesting we're not able to see clearly what taking seriously Jewish power, Israeli power, looks like and what it must mean for a just execution of a just war. This perspective is new. This is,
here you go.
This is young.
And it's the community.
So this is, I mean, it's a wonderful thing to see. The Jewish future that might can think through these things differently because they are not so bogged down, like with the sense of, well, it's not real power. Yeah, it's only power unless everybody decides to gang up on us again and destroy us. And, you know, and that's so our grandparents and parents and our experience. Well, not so much mine because, you know, miraculously Israel kept winning wars. So I grew up with a kind of confusing trope.
One more thing on that too. Real quick. We have new tools, I want to say, also in fighting war that our grandparents, you know, warned us. You will have a weapon at one point, but you might not know what that looks like. And for some people, for young women in regiments of tanks, like, hey, Girl Power IDF is publishing, like, all women driving tanks. And, like, that's a big deal. And not even our military will do that in the U.S., for example. But the information war that you brought up earlier is humongous. I know for me as freedom fighter, I'm like, yeah, to counter those algorithms, it takes the empowerment and strength to use those tools, whether they are social media or the power of our relationships or whatever, to not just create peace, but to fight back against some of the messages that are countering the power, which we do inherently have by nature of our existence. Thank you. That's what I want to say. Thank you.
On the other hand, says Bert of a different generation. Well, look at Robin nodding already before Bert even talks. Look at Robin nodding already.
Many of us live in the shadow of the protocols of the Elders of Zion.
Certainly.
And anti-Semitism for so long has preached the fact that there's a Jewish cabal that secretly controls the entire world.
There isn't?
I don't know. I was not invited. I think that for many Jews, there's no, because of all the accusations, Jews control the media, Jews secretly control the White House. At least Barack Obama wasn't a secret Jew. He was a secret Muslim. And so I think that part of our reaction is to be uncomfortable with the idea that we're very powerful. Because we've been accused unjustly of being crazy.
And I want to be clear that Kurtzer understands that.
Yeah,
he's just saying you don't get to keep using that as an excuse. You have to get it that we have real power. And you have to do what is ethical and moral. And it's not clear what that is. I'm not suggesting it's clear. He's not saying, and that means this. He's saying, if you don't start at a place that acknowledges your real power because you don't like that they claimed and they accused and that was an excuse, blah, blah, blah. If you keep going there and you don't accept that you have real power, then you cannot deal in the real world of what is ethically and morally problematic or fulfilling our ethics and morals and values around power. Because you're not even having the real conversation if you're still back at, yeah, but they said we had power over Hollywood. Yes, that's all true. No one's suggesting it isn't. This, we're having a different conversation, which is embrace the reality that is we are now powerful. And we need to have a Jewish conversation around what does that ethically and morally mean for what we can do and cannot do. And it's not clear. It has to be a real argument and a real conversation, but we can't even start that if we don't start at that premise. All right.
Is he saying that disbelief in our own power is also present in Israeli society?
Yes.
And Israeli decision making?
Yes.
But from the outside, a lot of times what it looks like is Israel says, through you to the rest of the world, we do what we have to do to take care of ourselves. We have the power and we're going to use it. But it could be that they're so fearful.
Correct.
That they think we will overreact and do everything and not give it a minute's thought because we don't believe that we're actually safe.
Correct.
So I did.
Correct. So unless and until it's taken seriously that we are incredibly powerful, there's going to be reactions that, and I don't even say reactions, there's going to be decisions made that are not coming from the actual ethical, moral execution of power, mm-hmm. right? Whatever they are. And I think that is an absolute truth that
in Israel
and American Jews as well. But in Israel, a lot of this is because they're afraid they're going to destroy us. Like, you, and we've always been the victims and we're not going to have it anymore. And not this time, never again. All of that is still a reaction to being powerless. It's not saying we are a sovereign nation with, we won't talk about what kind of weapons. And we, you know, and so then we have to really think about, okay, what does that mean about what we do in a place like Gaza? Right? Okay. So I want to get to, I see you, David. All right. So, we're going to get to where he's going, which is, blah, 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 blah. We must be cautious about assuming that power is always a moral good. Second paragraph on the page we were on. Our tradition and our recent history offer many cases of how a fixation with power can be weaponized by immoral actors in the name of Judaism and the Jewish people. Since power can be intoxicating and over self-affirming, we need guardrails, to your point, Lori, to ensure that it is always an instrument rather than an end, right? So rather than we'll show you that it's never going to happen again. You know, this is the crux of David Hartman's argument in an essay, Auschwitz or Sinai, as he lays out his fear that a culture of victimhood will define the character of modern Israel instead of the more aspirational culture of covenantal responsibility. This is exactly to what you just said. Okay. A commitment to compassion as an essential feature of maintaining our humanity can serve as a necessary constraint on power without constraining our capacity to fight a war. Drop down to the end sentence on that paragraph. By sustaining an overflowing and undiscriminating reservoir of compassion for the victims of the power at our disposal, even in a war that we support, we prevent that power from becoming an end in itself. Compassion means that people matter. When the IDF is slandered, and even in moments when I wonder from afar about its strategy, I personalize the IDF by visualizing the faces of my nephews and cousins and friends and colleagues who make up its ranks. This helps me remember that wars are fought by people doing their best, people to whom I ordinarily grant the benefit of the doubt and must continue to do so. Rhetoric matters too. When Israeli ministers and public officials are reckless or racist with the language they use to describe the enemy or the mission, it undermines the moral legitimacy of the war, and we are right to protest. We dare not look away from the faces of the innocent victims in Gaza, and especially the children. Compassion makes us and keeps us human. As the war drags on, with casualty numbers mounting, a morally serious commitment to power, meaning owning our power, and to compassion creates needed guidance in the form of support for the tragic necessity of Israel to wage a war that protects its citizens, and in the form of unending mourning for the innocents caught in its grips. And he's going to close with, all of these are the core locations on our moral map. But the moral end in war, the only possible moral end is peace.
Amen. Mm-hmm.
Dropping down to the third paragraph, peacemaking is an essential and absolute commitment. And sometimes war is a necessity. Sometimes a war to eradicate an evil opponent, particularly an opponent that will not accede to peaceful terms, who will not abide by the rules of war, who can only engage in a language of violence and force, is a precondition for making peace. Next paragraph in the middle, a moral map is a case for slower and more serious deliberation because it is a heuristic for moral thinking. It does not offer reflexive responses for all situations. Such partisanship and the mapping of moral language directly onto clear policy positions is not credible in this moment. You can't just make a sweeping moral statement and go, therefore, the IDF can never, must always, right? There's no way to do that. It's too tricky. It's too nuanced. It's too complicated. He gets that. In the middle of the next paragraph, equipped with our moral commitments and maintaining something of a humble and supportive posture towards Israelis as they navigate the realities of this war, we should continue to speak the language of peace. We must always pray for peace, but we dare not make it an unyielding demand. We do not want to live in peace as imposed by an imperial power that suppresses our national aspirations, and we should not seek to impose peace on others by suppressing their national aspirations. One moral frame is not enough for a war like this. The gift of a complex multivocal tradition, meaning ours, and of minds and hearts capable of holding multiple commitments at the same time is rewarded in the promise of some coherence and perhaps a community of fellow interpreters as we muddle through the impossible. This is the kind of thinking and language and application of the fundamental structures of our tradition that are inspiring to me. Again, you do not have to agree with him. You do not have to like what he says. This is what I think is needed. And it's only because I'm exposed to a lot from Hartman that I bring you what I know, which is Kurtzer. There are hopefully many people doing this. But I think for our class discussion, for Foundations for a Thoughtful Judaism that we're having in terms of our moral and ethical underpinnings and the ways we actually use them to talk about actual complicated, tragic ethical dilemmas for our time, this is the kind of Jewish thinking that for me makes me very proud to be Jewish. That it doesn't say turn the other cheek. Absolutely, at all times, or if they don't convert, kill them. Right? The absolutism of many ways of approaching things, I find the sophisticated Jewish thinkers of all ages have said is wrong. It's just not helpful, and it leads to terrible things. The ethical absolutes that you just smack on and slap onto every situation is unhelpful at least, and murderous at worst. And this kind of thinking is why we come back over and over and over again to the ethical texts and arguments about those texts that have been going on for generations, because I'm deeply proud of this kind of thinking and this kind of approach to what is people are so ready to see as black or white, right or wrong, right or left, the us or them. And I just think he's right that we have to have really serious conversations that are based in ethical language that have been the core tenets of our people for thousands of years. That doesn't mean what worked 1,000 years ago is what we should do now. It means let's take seriously the ethical commitments and let's find categories that we can agree to talk about that are relevant and applicable to the most heart-wrenching, existentially challenging situations that we have today. So I want to thank all of you for your time and attention, and thank you for staying with the journey. I know it's a lot. I know it's late. I know it's hard. And I think it's what we can do. I feel like, what can I do? I feel so helpless so much of the time, but I feel like this is what we can do. We can come back to our foundations. We can come back to our moral compass and then question which way is it pointing and how do we correct?